Hey everybody, this is the Brothers Whist number 34 with me, the beautiful Greg Soule. You can see the gleam off my head here in lovely Texas. So I'm going to go in order that I see these guys showing up on my monitor. We've got Tom Smith from Ireland.
Hello guys.
Lovely.
And ladies.
And Hillary especially, right?
Hillary, I love you.
All right, then we up in the top left corner, we've got Thomas Kernick out of Slovakia.
Hello, hello.
Awesome. Again, we have Alex Hart making a comeback. He's up in Portland now, right?
Correct.
Excellent. Excellent. I guess all he wants to say is correct. He doesn't want to say hello.
Hello, everybody from Portland, Oregon.
There you go. And then we have the lovely, handsome, immutable Andrew Cox all the way from Brisbane, Australia.
G'day, fellas.
G'day.
Oi.
Oi.
I've been, it's been a little while since I've been using my Bogan, so I don't know that I could keep pace the way I could for a hot minute there. So let's see. So we've got a whole list of topics, mostly news related. So let's jump right in, get going. We had at the top of the list that UBNT's Air Control Version 2 released out of beta. And from what I understand, this is their first kind of control product to come out of beta. Do any of you guys use Air Control?
I gave up on that years ago.
All right. Yeah, I don't know anybody else using it either. Maybe Mike used it a little bit. I know he's a Cambium guy now, so he doesn't really use much Ubiquiti stuff as far as the Wisp goes. All right. So
some of my clients who like went to the dark side, you know, years ago and went with Ubiquiti are using it, and they're saying that the more recent versions are quite good. Like, so I haven't much experience in it myself, though.
Gotcha.
Have they actually added support for all of their products, or are they still hit and miss? You guys know?
I don't have a clue. I don't use it.
I think for our customers, it seems to be like the main, let's say the mainline Ubiquiti products, you know, the ones that they're, let's probably sell it, the most popular ones, like, you know, the M5s or whatever, or the dish ones. What are those ones? You know, the dish with the either AC or the N. It would have been originally N, and now you can just get an AC head first.
Like the nano bridges, those things?
With the dish, yeah, and then the
it's just got the horn that pops right in the front.
Exactly, that's the one. Yeah. So those ones with the, they're supported anyway, and that's all I know.
All right.
Okay.
But they're, the guys are pretty happy with it, actually. We think it's quite a functional platform.
Right. Rock and roll. Sorry, Alex, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'd be interested to see a running install, see what they actually landed on for their final release. I know they played around with a lot of different concepts over the years.
It's made a lot of different revisions. Yeah, so I guess for anybody who's listening that doesn't really understand what Air Control is, it's a unified platform to administer Ubiquiti stuff. Not like Unify, this is more on the Wisp side, right?
Right.
All right, excellent. Moving right along, Mike put up a post on Facebook for the, I'm gonna guess at this, I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, the Vubic? Is that how you guys would guess? You say that company? V-U-B-I-Q, Vubic?
Yeah, that's probably a good guess.
Right, which it sounds awfully familiar, you know. Sounds somewhat like Ubiquiti. But Ubiquiti, and they call it the Hall Pass V10G, which you drop the P and it sounds a lot cooler. So this is supposed to be a 10 gig wireless link. They're saying it's full duplex. It's interesting. It's only about 10 inches in diameter, so it's about the size of a pie plate. And they are saying, I want to think somewhere it said full duplex 10 gig wireless link. And somehow I doubt that means you're doing 10 gig both directions, or am I supposed to assume that's what it means? Right, marketing is so tricky these days with vendors.
I'd say full duplex, so.
What I found really funny about it, that they advocated as a full 10 gig duplex wireless, but it only has two 1.25 gigabit SFP ports.
What has that? But it, if you you dig around on the specs a little bit further, they have an SFP Plus port on it too.
Ah, okay, that makes more sense then.
But they have it kind of hidden, so it's a little bit. It's weird the way their stuff reads. It says 2x 1.25 gigabit Ethernet and 10 gigabit fiber wireless link. So the way they say 10 gigabit, yeah, it's really kind of confusing. But they're saying
10 gigabit fiber wireless link, so...
Yeah.
It's got the two modes, so it's got your Ethernet and then, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny the way they put that, like, right up the top.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, two by 1.25.
Yeah, if you scroll down and look at, like, network interfaces, they actually list that they have an SFP plus port on this thing. I think they're saying it has PoE plus plus, which I'm not sure. I didn't even know that was a thing. I guess I'm just out of you guys.
It uses a shitload of power is what they're trying to say. Right.
Yep.
Well, I think a lot of power, a lot more than ample.
Well, I think it's saying that it only uses like 35 watts, or am I crazy? So
that's the separate. If you're powering it with just a separate auxiliary 48 DC input, so 48 volts DC, then it draws less than 35 watts. But maybe over PoE, it draws a different amount.
Hmm. Okay.
I'm thinking for a 10 gig link, just get a telescope. Put an SFP plus the eyepiece, get another telescope, point it at him, line him, job done.
Yeah. So looking at their marketing, it looks like it's not, I mean, this isn't a distance link. This thing's only, I think it's just a little bit over a mile you can do with it. Was it like 1.4 kilometers or something like that? So it's
1.8 kilometers or 1.1 miles for those of you talking weird distances.
If you're talking an American. Yeah. And so looking at their chart too, I think it's really cute. So I'll have to dig around here on this thing to look at frequencies that it's using. But they have this adaptive chart where it shows it switching from different QAMs. You know, so it shows like sunny, no, and then, you know, as you start getting a little precipitation, it's basically it chunks down to at lowest modulation rate, it's saying 400 megabits. And I think the channel sizes were crazy. Channel bandwidth. 500
megahertz minimum.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Well, it says
500 megahertz channel width minimum by the looks.
Yeah. It's saying 100 megahertz to 2 gigahertz. So those are some pretty large channel sizes. And they are in license-free V-band transmit 5.8, or rather 58, and high 62. So yeah, they're way up there. In the spectrum.
Any 80 gigahertz stuff or anything like that, no?
Yeah, 58 gigahertz and 62 gigahertz. So, yeah, it's way up there and near the 60 gigahertz range. So, yeah, so it's going to be extremely susceptible to rain fade, which is why you see such short distances. And even at 10 inches, it's got a 38.5 dBi gain. So it's fairly high gain. It's going to be extremely directional. I guess it's going to be very sensitive to tuning, too. You're going to have to really get this guy. I have zero idea what the street price is on any of this stuff. You guys have any clues?
Well, there was another product that came out that was announced a little while ago, company that I also hadn't heard of called Elva One. And they also have a 10 gigabit length millimeter wave. So I'm curious how they compare. And I actually dug into some pricing on that one, but
where was that one?
That was the
in
one that was around 25 grand, wasn't it?
It was 35.
35.
So that's 35, yeah, both sides.
I think that's for a pair.
Yeah, complete length 35.
For the distances as well. I mean, like, you really have to be unable to pull fiber. Like,
yeah, I was gonna say a mile of fiber shouldn't cost you that much.
Well, it really depends on if you're digging up the streets, though, right?
You are, yeah.
Yeah, if you're
it's
in
a CBD,
dense...
maybe.
If you're hitting up on the poles, then fiber's going to be very cheap. But if you're trying to dig through a downtown area, that can get very costly very quick. And, you know, that might be a good use for something like this.
Yeah, for sure. Or even if it is cost-efficient to do it in that area, speed... Right, so like I know
right.
If you're trying to go in Houston, I mean, just pulling permits to do work like that, it's going to take you 3 months to 6 months. So,
even if you just had a pair on hand that you used as a "we'll get you up and running today" solution, while you're pulling fiber in, you're waiting on the permits, all that kind of stuff, I could see a use for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or in disaster recovery, like disaster response, you know, like post 9/11, that type of scenario, mm-hmm. This type of gear would be invaluable, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, it could be. Shorter
God forbid that there's anyone requiring that, but, you know, shit happens, I suppose, you know.
All right, for sure. Let's move on to a little bit of MikroTik news. We're going to save a rant that Tom's got boiling over, He's a little tea kettle over there, just steaming at the top. But just a little bit of news. We've got MikroTik announced some 638 release candidate stuff. And one thing that was somewhat interesting was LLDP, just to kind of touch on. Thomas played around with it just a bit, right? He gives him the slow clap. All right.
Good job, MikroTik. Good job. Now just finish the implementation completely, and you'll have my love.
In all fairness, it's still just a release candidate. It's not a full release yet. So they've got several iterations to add whatever people want them to add, right?
Can I ask, because I'm one of these security guys who turns off that type of stuff. Like, it's literally like, it's on a server, turn it off. It's on a switch, turn it off. What purpose does LLDP serve other than, let's say, the CDP stuff that on the surface that I would associate with discovery? Like, what use is LLDP in the real world, apart from security folk like me turning the stuff off all the time every time I see it?
Yeah, and to that end too, and I'm going to force you guys to say, but what is LLDP and how does it work? Just in kind of a 30 second window.
I was going to give him about a minute to 5 minutes.
Go ahead, Alex. What do you got? I heard you starting.
Well, I was just going to cut in on some uses of it, but I think Thomas probably wants to tell us all about it.
you don't want to tell about it.
Go ahead.
Okay, and by the way, you have a minute to 5 minutes. Don't mind Greg. Sorry, Greg.
So, link layer discovery protocol, right? The idea is that it's a standard that everybody can use, and you can use it with great tools like NetXMS to map out your network. So being able to know what device you're connected to, what the local port is and the far port, and use that information to map out your network. I would say absolutely on the security point that you would turn that off on all customer-facing ports, but using it internally as a tool to see what you're connected to and learn the topology, you know, especially if you don't happen to have as-built network diagrams. I don't know, it could be a great troubleshooting tool to see how things are mapped out, especially if you're going into a new environment where you're maybe doing some consulting, being able to turn that on or already have it on and get an idea of how things are laid out.
Yeah, absolutely. This is very akin to like Cisco's CDP, right, where it's neighbor discovery. So there's been a lot of networks where I popped in and they don't have a clue what's going on, so it's show CDP neighbor, and then you connect to that switch and you just keep doing that so you can kind of map it out. But, I mean, there's uses beyond just neighbor discovery. Can't you do aren't there like some IP phones and things like that that use LLDP?
There's actually an extension that's called LLDP MED or LLDP MED that is aimed at IP phones and SIP and stuff like that.
Right.
So basically what we're saying is it's a vendor-neutral version of CDP that has extensions to find media endpoints and things, so your phones and other bits and pieces.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I don't know that applies to your average WISP, but if you're doing anything else, it's probably going to be useful.
I would say it's useful in any scenario, really. Just having the power of enabling a protocol and suddenly having all of your topology data available in a standard format is a huge power. Again, from the security standpoint, obviously you would turn this off on customer-facing ports or end-user, end-station ports, etc. But inside of your actual secure ports, where you know what's connected and you know that it interconnects your whole topology, it's just very, very useful to be able to have that topology data accessible.
I would also say beyond your forwarding database and your ARP tables and things like that, in the data center perhaps, where you have servers connected to top rack switches and you're trying to figure out what's connected where. Maybe you don't want to do it on MAC address. If you have LLVP enabled on the servers, it's easy to see how things are connected that way as well.
That was actually where I was heading as well, because one of the most time-saving things you can have is this, because, for example, in our cluster, each of our compute nodes in our cluster has 6 network cards, and 4 of those are for iSCSI traffic, and 2 of those are for actual production or data traffic, and those are going to various switches for redundancy and etc. And it saved me so much time to just be able to click on a port and immediately see which port on which server it's connecting you to. You can imagine if you have a bigger cluster and each node of the cluster has 6 network cards going all across the redundant switches and across the racks, it just helps and saves time a lot.
And does VMware support it? I know that VMware supports the LLD or CDP, like if you have CDP neighbors, it'll identify the port and stuff like that. Is it the same with LLDP? Does VMware, you know, when you go into the networking, it has a little, almost like a speech box, and it kind of
It's actually supported, but same as with CDP, only on a virtual distributed switch, which is only available with an enterprise plus license. So it's supported, but only on VDS, virtual distributed switch.
Okay. I haven't tried it, but I imagine on the Proxmox alternative, it's either available or something that you can easily install and get that functionality as well.
Yeah, for me, it's just really nice to, you know, check a few boxes inside of the configuration, and then just with one click inside of NetXMS, since NetXMS can read those LLDP topological data over SNMP, you have automatic dynamic maps of your network, of your topology constructed, and that's a really, really powerful tool.
For sure,
Unfortunately, that was one of the things that the current release candidate lacks with MikroTik, right? They added LLDP, but they didn't build in the SNMP support.
Yeah, so there is a few issues, and I'm really hoping MikroTik is going to iron those out before they release the full version. Because having LLDP is nice, but currently the way it's implemented in this beta of RouterOS is that, first of all, you don't have any LLDP peer table within RouterOS. So you can't actually see your LLDP peers within RouterOS. And secondly, the LLDP topological data is not in SNMP. So it seems to me they added outbound LLDP, so LLDP transmit, but they aren't processing inbound LLDP yet, which I hope is just a beta thing which will get ironed out before the full release.
Otherwise,
without the LLDP data being in SNMP, it's much less useful.
Yeah, it's first candidate, initial release, right? So it's there. They're going to be building on it. So one of the things they've just recently done, a lot of new little things popping up for them, is they did a website redesign, right? It's very Apple-ish, very kind of ubiquity-ish, if I'm allowed to say that. Have you guys had a look at it yet? Trolled around it a bit?
The only thing I would say is, in MikroTik's defense, ubiquity is on the dark side, you know, it's black, while MikroTik is on white side, so it's the, you know, it's the light side of the force, you know.
Sure. I noticed, so at one point they did a redesign on routerboard.com, and following that they redesigned the theme for the forums. And now they've launched their new website. I think it's good that they're working on their image and their marketing and branding and making things easier to understand and navigate and things like that. So.
Yeah,
the website was really starting to show that 2000s look.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And I mean, traditionally they don't do a lot of marketing, right? So maybe this is kind of a first step into that. That would be interesting. Or is it maybe just a facelift? Either way, it looks better. I don't know that there's any new functionality there, but it looks nice.
I'm surprised they don't. That they added the new website. I'm surprised at some point, or I would be surprised at some point if they didn't bring routerboard.com into the same website. I don't know that there's value in having those separated.
Maybe. They've actually kind of done that slightly. They're kind of on the way, I think, because if you click on products, it brings you to routerboard.com. No, like, look, I think, yeah, like, I think we've long said it, like, when I was selling or pushing MikroTik as a, let's say, more of a wholesaler, I would have long lamented their inability to market some of the great features that they have. So I think it is positive that they do it. I think it's a positive because if you compare and contrast ubiquity versus MikroTik, Ubiquiti are newer to the game, but they had a very steep curve in terms of turnover, market penetration, and sales. You know, while if you look at MikroTik, you know, if you look at pound for pound in terms of the feature set, MikroTik had the feature set, you know, that kind of way, but no one knew about them, you know, that kind of way.
Yeah, look, I'd also say pretty much everything Ubiquiti have put out, they go to the nth degree to make sure that their websites, their portals and everything are, it's like very now web, it's web 2.0, web 3.0, everything's done in HTML5. I was playing with the cloud keys the other day, they all communicate using WebRTC to actually get data between them. Like, it's, they put a lot of work into that customer facing interface and everything, whereas MikroTik's like, we have the good features, we have the good costs, like, it's,
yeah, well, I mean,
we can upgrade that later.
I think it definitely goes with the mindsets of the two companies. One is Ubiquiti is very experience focused and the flow, yeah, and the feel of the product, whereas MikroTik is very feature focused, right? It needs to have all these features and all this functionality, and has this number of ports, right? Where, so it's, you can definitely tell the website's always sort of focused, right? So with that customer like experience focus being number one right off the bat, they they definitely, I think, played to that with their user interfaces.
And don't get me wrong, I've heavily invested, let's say, my efforts and my life in MikroTik related products. But if you look at both of them, I think Ubiquiti have the edge. That I think MikroTik needs to learn more from Ubiquiti in that regard. And that's no disrespect to the management or leadership of MikroTik. It's just that user experience, like, the whole reason why I love MikroTik was it was easier than compiling shit into a Linux kernel. It was easier than finding that magic setting in a config file buried somewhere on a Linux file system. And even when, you know, you look for alternatives, like with likes of OpenBSD or anything like that, you know, MikroTik is easier to use than that. Ubiquiti is easier to use than MikroTik. Mm-hmm. Ubiquiti are an evolution of that. And you see it with the turnover in terms of the business side of things. Ubiquiti, I think, can teach MikroTik a few things still. And it's good that MikroTik are learning. Like, this is a positive thing to change. But and I'm saying that just... And the funny thing is, I'm not a Ubiquiti user, but I'm an observer of... And I'm seeing how their thought process, or how they actually present to the normal user. And it is nothing short of impressive. It's very Apple-esque. Again, I'm not an Apple user, but people, you know, the way Apple users sell to other people, you know, the way that kind of that Steve Jobs or, you know, Tim Cook, they kind of go, here's the new phone, and he'll talk to 50,000 people. And those 50,000 people are really the early adopters, and then they'll sell to the rest of the world. So it's not Apple selling to the rest of the world. It's these lads go, my laptop, it has this like energy storage device, and it works for 8 hours nonstop. It's called a battery. We won't call it a battery, but it's just 8 hours of life. It's amazing. You know, you should buy an Apple. And you know, it's this almost cult-like stuff that I think, and in fairness, I think MikroTik miss out on a little bit of that they've kind of gone with a lovely GUI around the Linux kernel, but lose sight of the user experience, that they kind of go, we have all these features, they're slightly disorganized, and it's just, you know, they need to refine it a bit more. Like, if you look at it, Ubiquiti has less features, but it's more refined in terms of user experience. And I think if MikroTik learned that lesson, they'd be unstoppable.
Well, I think some of that, I mean, if you want to dive down into marketing, there's this book called It Starts With Why, you know, and it's kind of the marketing engine for your company is figure out why you do things. Andrew's familiar. I've talked to him about this book at a very awkward moment. One of the things they say in there is kind of like how Apple sold the iPod, right? They didn't sell it as, because they were competing against somebody who'd already had the market, already dominated the market, much in the same, similar to the scenario as this. But they said, instead of telling people, you know, it's got 5 gigs of storage and this much battery life, they said, hey, you've got a jukebox in your pocket, you know, and imagine your life with all of your music with you, right? So instead of focusing on these are the specs they have, these are the technical things they can do, they said, hey, imagine how your life is going to be different now with this, right? So they appealed to our baser selves, that little kid inside your head that says, hey, I want that new shiny toy instead, right? So it's a different spin on marketing, right? And so that's, I think Ubiquity appeals a little bit to that, right? That counterculture sort of thing.
I think it's also very important to consider the target market, because marketing like that might work for a customer appliance, but for a networking world or IT world, it's just a whole different ballgame. And for example, Ubiquity's user experience is great, but if you give me a choice between Ubiquity Wireless and MikroTik Wireless, I am going to pick MikroTik Wireless any day and every day, simply because Ubiquity lacks what I consider essential features. And in the end of the game day, yes, I mean, user experience is really important, but when you are deploying hundreds or thousands of devices, user experience doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
It really doesn't. It's different target markets, different, objectives for the companies, and there is a lot to consider, right?
Yeah.
I would tend to disagree on some fronts there, Tom. I think if you're looking at large businesses, yeah, you've got someone who's going through and doing the full evaluation and comparing one product to another. But if you're looking at the small to medium business, then a lot of times it's about getting it in front of the person who makes the decision and then being impressed with it. And it doesn't matter if you've got a small WISP or something that has technicians there that say, oh, this product looks cool. You take it to the manager and go, look, you can log into this thing and see graphs of all your client stats and who's online and all of these bits and pieces. They go, oh, this cool whiz bang thing we can get. How much does it cost? How does it compare to, well, if it's Ubiquity or MikroTik, how much does it compare to MikroTik? And they're like, well, it's about the same, really. So you go, yeah, I want this fancy one that I can look at. I can log in from wherever. And those are the people that are making the decisions a lot of the time. It's not necessarily the person that has the technical understanding and knows exactly what the pros and cons are of each one. It's the manager there that wants more information, wants something that's easy for them to look at, and at the end gets to go, yep, I'm going to put my credit card down to this company or this company.
You know, it again depends on the target market, right?
Because exactly.
Like, Tom, I'd agree with you in lots of cases, particularly in the wireless. As much as I lament the usability of the MikroTik wireless interface, I agree that it has a lot of great features. And when they have the stability in their drivers, they're unstoppable. I do emphasize when they have the stability in their drivers. But in terms of Andrew's, I remember having a conversation with clients who we were losing back in 2008, 2009 to the Ubiquity, the UBNT, was it the NanoStation, the first one, like the horrible RF device, you know, it was like a kind of...
The logo?
The Nano.
Small plastic and brick.
I was trying to explain to customers, look, the RIC522s, you know, the diamond-shaped MikroTik antenna was much better, or any of the ones we were retrofitting, let's say, with Rutenas and stuff like that. With MikroTik 411s or 123 C3s. And I was saying, but look at all the features you can have with MikroTik. You know, this is what you should be having. And more what, and this, so this was the argument I was making, the one that Thomas Kiernak is making, and the one that I believed myself, and the one that I chose for my own network. But then I had someone like Andrew, like what Andrew's talking about, but it was a technical guy. As well as a manager, he goes, one, Tom, I can deploy two of these for every one of yours. That's the first thing. Second of all, you're saying about all these features. When do you really use all the advanced MikroTik features on a CPE, or do you do a DHCP server, NAT, wireless client, scan, connect, leave site, happy?
Well, and happy until the virus forum, right?
And that was the problem. And that's where Ubiquity were very smart. They got the bare essential things and they said, people will work to this if a technical person can work. Now, don't get me wrong. As in, a good person with experience could make the Ubiquity back then, the very limited Ubiquity that we knew then, work, you know, and structured and use MikroTik as access points, and use MikroTik as QoS routers up with a head end. And that's effectively what they did. And it was, I think, a very smart MikroTik to appeal to that business side of things, that the bare minimum functionality for a client unit will win out.
And so,
and they've grown on it. Like, yeah. You know, I saw EdgeOS there briefly before I installed OpenBSD on the routers. And I was very pleasantly surprised at the progress they've made in a very short amount of years, like, you know.
Okay. So kind of going back a little bit to target market that Andrew was talking about and Thomas was talking about, hey, let me pose a question to you. Could you go to an average, say, a server guy, and he's going to do a wireless link, could you hand him two MikroTiks and have him make it work? Or could you hand him two simple Ubiquiti devices and have him make it work? Which one of those scenarios do you see working out the best in the end?
Are you talking about for a point-to-point wireless connection?
Yeah, he's got two buildings and he's going to do it, right? Or some guy's researching on the internet, hey, I've got to do this little point-to-point thing, and he's just a server guy, he's not a network guy. Which of those two products do you think he'll be able to make work?
Greg, I want to come in after whoever answers that question.
I'm going to throw my opinion out, and I've seen a lot of nano bridges and things like that out in the wild, configured by server guys, because they're so simple. They can go up there,
just point and click.
They can figure it out. I liken it to.
You can do the same with Quickset, right?
Well,
you can.
I can't believe that honestly just came out of your mouth, Thomas.
I know everybody is frowning, and I was frowning too. But in the end,
it is true. It is true that you can't.
But Quickset wasn't an option for a while, right?
But it is now.
So still though,
Quickset is a band-aid, and Quickset isn't a strategic vision.
Look at it this way. We are frowning at MikroTik for having that, you know, five-click functionality, and it does its job, but it's acceptable for Ubiquiti, you know. And realistically, the final feature set, the final effect for that server guy is the same, right? He clicked five buttons, and he has a wireless link. So, you know.
The ongoing is different, though. The ongoing for that server guy is like, how do I tweak this?
The difference is the Ubiquiti model is, here's the selection of features we're going to enable for you, and you're going to get a good quality link out of it, or potentially a good quality link out of it.
Yeah.
Quickset is like a hack of kind of a subset of features, and that if you click on it after the fact, you'll break other configs that you did outside of Quickset.
But that doesn't matter for the server guy. He won't even know what, you know, a frequency is if we are talking about that target market. Again, yeah. I think it's very important to consider the target market.
No, fair enough. But what I'd be saying is that the Quickset is not a strategic...
It's not them moving into that space. They're not continuing.
What they did was they tried to backfill, let's say, deficiency in their workflow of their... Like the primary interface, they could have made their primary interface more user friendly and not try and backfill it with
adding a menu that makes things easier.
That breaks other stuff.
I think
they could have strategically, they could have used the opportunity to say, we have an issue with our, I think Quickset is an acknowledgement from MikroTik that they had an issue with their workflow. And instead of actually grasping the nettle and actually saying, let's make this better, they actually said, let's bolt on another interface on top of, as a side to this interface.
But at the same time, I could see why they would want to leave the advanced interface that people are...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
But also it's appealing to the new user and saying, here are some templates to get you going quickly if you haven't used our product before. And I think that they're filling a need. That doesn't mean that they couldn't improve some of the advanced interface intuitiveness and user friendliness and things like that.
Well, I mean,
that comes back to this whole thing of like who is that market though? If you get the server guy setting up one of these Ubiquiti links and coming back to it later on going, how can I improve this? And then coming back to the MikroTik and going, how can I improve this? Well, like the the Ubiquiti stuff, you get all of the information about the link there because it's the device you're installing is made to do a wireless link, whereas the MikroTik can do whatever you want it to do. Like, you can start playing music on it if you want, and that's the underlying difference there. So the server guy looks at it and goes, I have no idea where to go now. Like, I need to take a course to understand what all of these options are, or why there is 500 options hidden under the wireless interface.
I think it does speak a lot to the user base too, right? So I've seen a lot of the work, virtually, I would say 90% of the networks that I go into that are 100% bridged, that they need help overhauling their Ubiquiti networks, right? Very infrequent do I get calls from people that have an entire MikroTik network where it's bridged, right? So it seems like the different skill sets kind of sort of lean towards different technologies too, I think.
Yeah, well, like, in fairness, you can have well-designed bridged networks. It's just rare because people usually selected it because it was easy. You know, and that's what I think, Craig, you're saying.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, like, how, you know, I feel like I'm a football commentator and I'm talking about, like, a team that I love, and I just kind of go, they could do so much better. that's the way I feel about MikroTik. Like, I know that, like, I'm often very controversial and very, unfortunately for them, offensive to them, and I don't mean to be. But, like, it's a good product. It could be so great. But the good positive thing I will say about this is that they are learning from the likes of Ubiquiti. And that's a good thing, because them learning from Ubiquiti will push Ubiquiti, because Ubiquiti sure as hell are learning from MikroTik on the technical feature side of things. You know, we can't deny
what not to do.
There've been massive technical achievements. There've been massive technical faux pas. John Tully, Arnis, you know it. I love you guys. Well, I love Arnis more than John. I think Arnis loves me more than John, definitely.
You just like that sexy Latvian accent, right?
No, there's... So,
anyway, back to your point.
What I say is MikroTik are improving, and I think Ubiquiti are a large part in that, in terms of the user interface. They have a long way to go, but I think things like the website is a positive step. But QuickSet, I have to say, is nothing more than a band-aid and an omission about their main interface.
What about?
I'm not saying hide anything.
Look at airplanes. You know, they have all the controls in there, and then they retrofitted them with autopilots. All the controls are still there, but it's just a simpler method to perform the same operations, maybe more consistent and repeatable. Makes it easier, right? So it's not necessarily a bad thing.
I'm guessing that the people that design airplanes and the autopilot systems maybe do a little bit more QA.
Brother, I know a pilot that he flew for 15 years, and he said every now and then you'd have to reboot the 737 mid-flight. He said sometimes something would go wrong, you just have to reboot it. You just wouldn't tell anybody. So,
yeah, but that's okay.
Our entertainment system will go offline for 2 minutes.
Right.
You know, there's nothing more that the passengers need to know, right?
Yeah, you just hit control delete in the cockpit, and then boom.
To be fair, one of my friends works as an aircraft electrical engineer, and he's just posting the other day, we've got to do some updates to the Boeings we have here, and he's pulled out like a picture of a stack of floppy disks with a new version.
Oh my God. Actually, I will say this is like I was a Windows admin, then went Linux, then went OpenBSD and all that. But there was one day there was a problem with a streaming server, and I ran in, and of course it was a blank screen, and I went in and I went Control Alt Delete, you know, to log in, because that's what you do to a Linux server. Of course, it didn't harden the fucking thing, and of course it just decided. Sig term, blah, 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 and you're just going, no, want to shut it down. So it just restarted. Of course, it was a hard bare metal box, and people were coming in like, you know, everything's off now. It just was one stream, and I went, it'll be back up in about 5 minutes.
It's part of the process.
It said, Control-Alt-Delete. And he was going, oh, you didn't. And I went, Windows, what can I say? Yeah. Can we cut that one out of this video?
Never. So I think one takeaway from this is we need to set up an experiment. We need to give a server guy two microchicks, say, create me a wireless bridge, and then two ubiquities, and see what shenanigans ensue. I'm just curious, you know?
Now, hey. Does that just have to pass traffic, or are we going to see which one performs better?
No, I just user. I'm especially interested in user experience, like learning curve. Like, how long does it take the guy? What problems did he run into on each one?
Knowing the costs, which would he go with?
Yeah. It's like, so if you had to pick one of these straight off the bat, which would you? Yeah, I don't know. That'd be interesting. While we're still kind of talking about MicroTik and everything, something interesting, Alex dug up the other day, pasted, and then dropped the mic and walked away for a half hour. was a build log picture. I guess it was all the folder structure for some MicroTik version 7 alphas, and it looked like they had up to 134 build 134 alpha on there, which is pretty interesting. So there's no semblance of timeline, like how long they've been working, what, you know, is it a week between
how long between builds?
Yeah, any of that stuff. Yeah. So, but it's interesting. I don't have the picture in front of me, but they had a list of the different hardware architectures they've already compiled it for, and it looked like, I don't know if it was complete, but it looked most of them.
It's from the MicroTik Twitter account. If anyone wants to have a look at it, we'll put the link in the description.
Absolutely.
Also, it was deliberately leaked by MicroTik.
It was a response to someone asking about Router OS 7. So they're just like,
hey, yeah, how's V7 going? And MicroTik just posts that.
I think that's just like laughing for.
I've been asking the wrong questions the wrong way. I keep asking them via email what the release date is, and this was somebody getting on social media saying, how's the progress? And they were able to, you know, kind of answer with a screenshot and not say anything else. So we can learn from that, right?
Gotcha. Yeah. Maybe you just need to pantomime all of your questions. Maybe they're just very visual, and then your response will come back picture form. So let's see. Next we have on the list MicroTik scripting with SNMP. So that was something that they sort of alluded to in the 637 change log, and it sounded like, hey, I can pull an SNMP OID on the router, and it will perform an action via a script and then return something back. I actually asked somebody at MicroTik, and he's like, I don't know. So Alex did some digging, and 5 minutes later, he actually had a test running. You want to give a few details on that, Alex?
Yeah, so I was just taking the complete directions from the release and what they had in their wiki, did some digging and figured some things out, and yeah, basically all of your scripts are exposed via SNMP. Initially that was supposed to be only for your community with write permissions, and they had to go back and fix that in the 6.3.8 release candidate, but you do an SNMP git on the whatever script that you have, and it will run the script and provide the return in a string format. So gotcha. That's kind of cool. I think they could do some things, you know, probably not exposing all your scripts is good, but at least you can lock it down to the write only. And, you know, you can obviously do things like change your community and use proper firewall rules and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see what people do with that. I could see it, you know, filling the gap in things that they don't already provide in SNMP. You could, you know, do some scripting to get that data out. So,
yeah.
Sorry, Alex. Cool. I have to step out for a second, but sorry for interrupting. Was there a possibility that you could do stuff in the scripts that would be kind of an elevation of privilege?
Oh, absolutely. You could. You can't create the script with SNMP, so it's only telling a script to run that you've already programmed into the device. But okay. if you had a bad script already written, or you know something that does something special that, you know, the average Joe maybe knows your community, you don't have firewall rules, the write access is enabled, and you can, you know which script it is you need to hit to perform a certain action, I could see that, you know, used in a wrong way. But I think they've done the right amount of things, at least to get it out the door, to give people that extra feature and capability without putting them at risk.
So you can't just run a command from us. It has to be a script. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Does it actually read you what the scripts are as well, or does it just give you a list of the script names?
They have a table with the script names. You can't see what the source is.
Can't see the individual. Okay.
Gotcha. But you could just do a walk against it, and it would activate every script?
You can't do that. They don't allow a walk over the script running. You can do a walk over the table to see which scripts are available. But you can only use SNMP git with write permissions to execute any of the scripts.
Very nice.
That's good.
But I think your demo script just did a hello world, right? So you pulled the script and just returned hello world?
Yep.
All right, awesome. So theoretically, there's a lot of different things you could do with that.
And we'll on that one, too, we'll post something on social media with a little example to show people how it works, because it's not super obvious in their wiki or release notes.
Yeah, that's cool. Sounds like you did a little bit more digging after the fact. That's cool. That's cool, cool. All right. So let's get to just a little bit of public news. The Yahoo hack, you guys heard about that, right? There, I think 2014 they had, what was it, about 500,000 accounts hacked?
I think it was 2012.
Was it that long ago? Golly.
Yeah, they kept it under wraps for quite a while.
That's a long while. What I thought was funny is when I read it, the guy behind me said, "Wow, they have 500 million users still, huh?" And I was just like, I know just a couple of people that still use Yahoo. I think it's bigger overseas, right? I don't know that it's.
Yeah, no, it's quite popular. Even before Marissa Meyer took it over, I think she's hot.
So I know Verizon's in talks to sell, or Yahoo's in talks to sell to Verizon for $4.8 billion. So I wonder how this is going to impact that sale price. I'm assuming it's going to hurt it a tad. But you know what? There's been other big businesses that had data breaches and ho-hum. They just kept trucking and it didn't really seem to affect them too bad. So I don't know that there's going to be any lasting or effective change based on this. I think it's interesting.
The only thing is, it is a Yahoo account, which is usually what's used for, you know, spam and like your kind of, you know, the subscriptions that you have to sign up to, but you don't really want. You know, you kind of go, "Oh, you use my Yahoo account." I know, in fairness, like, is there any progress on the investigation of which nation state, or was it just? Trump supporters, or was it just Russia trying to get Clinton's emails back? You know, as per Trump's request.
I'm not sure. I haven't looked that far into it. I think supposedly the only little bit of information I remember hearing about it was that some of those early email accounts, the hashing wasn't very good. I don't think they disclosed what the hashing was, so they were
actually they said it was bcrypt.
Okay, there you go. So maybe some of that stuff, the early stuff, was decryptable, and people could have got in from there. But yeah, again, I really don't know anybody that still uses Yahoo Mail. Or after this,
they've had 4 years to try and decrypt it now. So
yeah, bcrypt is actually a fairly decent encryption, or rather, hashing/encryption mechanism. It of course depends how it's configured, because it has multiple configurable options. For example, how many passes you do, you know, what's the key string and stuff like that. But yeah, they've had 4 years at this point, or even if 2 years, you know, it's.
Was it done with a salt, like, or can they just have a rainbow table where they just look up the hash and go, "Oh yeah, that's like, I hate my job. Okay, I got the password."
Well, you obviously will have, you know, pre-compiled rainbow tables and magic tables for everything, right? So, but still, it's years now at this point, so we can all just assume it's most of it has been broken by this point. But what is even worse is that they had. I would like to quote that they said there have been secondary security questions in the database which may or may not have been encrypted. So good job, yeah.
Gotcha. That's fun. And then I was reading something too that a lot of these throwaway accounts, people will use a common password that they use for all of their throwaway accounts, right? And those same passwords they use on throwaway accounts, they'll often use on common websites too, right? That they don't really give a crap about. So it can open other doors, right? So it is theoretically done. Yeah, yeah. But also, it comes down to the release. Why would they – I mean, obviously, for business purposes, they wouldn't release the information. But, you know, to what standard do we hold these companies to be able to answer about these kind of things? You know, it's unfortunate.
Well, in Ireland, any of the American companies working in Ireland, which you may have heard, like the likes of Facebook, Yahoo, and Microsoft – they all have to answer to the Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland, let's say for the European side of things, because most of the European stuff is handled out of Ireland for a lot of them. So even like German citizens who were suing were actually told, oh, I want to use the German Data Protection Commissioner. But they said, no, it's actually resident in Ireland. But data is in Ireland. You have to use the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. And they're basically saying that within 48 hours of becoming aware of an insecurity incident, or if you feel or if you believe that security has been put at risk, that data privacy has been put at risk, you have to notify within 48 hours. And then, like, you have to then obviously have a plan. So then you're discussing who was affected by it, how you're going to manage it, and all that type. You know, there's a whole, like, procedure. So I don't know where this data was held, but it does seem, to be fair, that — and this is something I'd like to ask the American guys, Europeans, like myself included, being one — they seem to have a lot more focus on privacy, and particularly companies trying to respect privacy of users, you know, that kind of way. And that is taken quite seriously in law, while in the US it seems like 2 years is — like, if you look at LinkedIn, the reason why LinkedIn kind of went public with it, I think that was — they went public within a week, so they would have notified the Data Protection Commissioner before that. Like, that's the timelines you're talking about. And that's probably because it was done out of Europe. You know what I mean? That they were actually, like, how come we're only hearing about this a couple of years later? Which I thought was 2014, or am I wrong on the timelines? Is it 2012 you're saying, or?
I may have been wrong. I think it actually was 2014.
I think it's 14 as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I think there were some rumors.
They had another one in 2012, but the big one was 2014.
Yeah.
Like, 2 years is a very long time to come public with, you know, while LinkedIn, in fairness, within a — I think it was a week of the breach, or maybe a month, I'm not too sure. But it was that type of scale of timeline. And I think it was probably because they were operating out of the likes of the Republic of Ireland, or in fact, maybe Germany at the time as well.
Interesting. Yeah, somebody popped in a link to leaked source useful for leak checking, and we'll put —
that was me.
There you go. Thank you, Thomas. And that's — what is that in a quick snapshot?
Leak source is basically a collection entity where they actually keep track all of the cyber breaches and attacks, and they actually collect all the leaked databases and then allow you to search for your data inside of those databases. So they have a huge amount of databases. They, of course, have the recent Twitter leak. They have the recent LinkedIn leak and the Russian leaks, which were huge, I think, about a month and a half ago. And, they just have — I think their database is, I could be wrong, but I think it's like half a billion entries.
Oh, I'm looking
from
right
various
now.
Leaks.
It says 2.2 billion in their database.
Ah, there you go. Thank you.
Yeah.
And basically, yeah, you can just search in there for your information, username, email, last name, first name, etc., and actually see how many of the various leaks and how many of the various hacks leaked publicly your information. So this is, of course, only the hacks that have leaked the information publicly, right? That the databases were given to public. They aren't a hacking group or anything similar. And it's just a useful little service. And if you find yourself in there, you can delete yourself. So they allow you to actually delete yourself from their database. And basically, they make their living on API subscription services, whether if you are an entity that really wants to keep track of your user accounts, you can pay a few bucks monthly. I think they charge some some monthly fee, and you have access to a full API where you can do periodic checks on your accounts and stuff like that. And it's just a really nice, funny thing, you know, type in your username and see how many entries you get.
I don't want
to. Now, is that similar to, there's another website called haveibeenfun.com, and you can search similarly, but they also give you a free option of entering, starting an account, having your email address and username, and if it ever comes up in the future, they'll notify you, say, hey, we found you in this leak. Does that site also do that?
So you can subscribe? You can. Yeah, exactly.
But just to go back, like with the American colleagues there, Alex and Greg, I suppose, pushing it at you, like what sort of data protection laws exist in the US? Is there any, or is it pretty much like the free for all? That big long terms and conditions page that no one ever reads and you hit accept to get your email address.
I do believe there is something, because I want to say that there were talks of maybe legal action being taken against Yahoo in California, maybe because of some kind of data protection laws or something like that. So yeah, there's something. I'm just not sure what. How about you, Alex? You have any idea?
Well, I would say that there are companies out there that can help. If a company experiences a breach, they'll help their users with their, you know, say their social security number gets out. There's some financial losses that are possible, and they'll help all of their customer base that was affected. I would also say that the government's very willing to step in and help these companies. So if a company goes to the government and says, hey, look, we had this thing happen, we need help, you know, they'll give them the resources they need to make sure that the public is taken care of. So I don't know if there's a legal obligation. I would assume that there is to some extent. I don't know what that extent is. And I think that's changing a lot too with all of the breaches that have been happening lately. I think that the public's demanding, like, hey, you got to get our back covered on this, because companies aren't always taking care of the end user's best interests.
Gotcha.
But using those tools to check for the leaks, and I think also just using good password practices, using a password manager like LastPass or something to use unique passwords at every site, I think that can go a long ways.
Well, that was one of the most impressive things about the Unimus database. You know, the way you had Thomas had implemented the database encryption, you know, like unique, no one else can know us. You know, even probably for the cloud base, you were probably thinking of it, but I have to say I was impressed, because, you know, you'd be kind of skeptical to pass all over the keys of the kingdom to this one database, this one Java app. Bearing in mind, I don't like Java, even though there's good reason for liking Java, but there's other reasons I don't like Java. But it's phenomenal, like the way, you know, that Thomas actually took it, like, security in depth approach to encryption data in the database, that if you lose that magic key, you know, that's it, there's gone, there's nothing, which is pretty cool, like, you know, and maybe all these breaches are making developers, even with respect, Thomas, a small developer or a new developer like yourself, like, that if the big companies actually start applying same methodologies that Thomas has with Unanimous, that'll actually make, I suppose, people's privacy a lot better protected going forward, you know?
Mm, for sure.
Hey, you can only hope, right?
I've got to run, but it's been great. Thank you, everyone, and make sure to change your passwords. Be safe out there on the internet.
Tip the waitstaff. See you later, Alex.
See you guys.
See you, Alex.
See ya.
See you, Alex.
All right. So moving on from that security matter to another quick one that caught a lot of media attention and caught my attention. I thought it was really interesting, is the Krebs on Security attack that happened. It was a big DDoS attack. Big as in the largest on record thus far. Krebs is a security researcher. He blogs and writes and does a lot of different stuff about security, and he's got a lot of people he blogs and writes about that are not big fans of his, obviously. And so they sent off a large-scale DDoS attack against him up to, I think it was 620 gigabits per second. And so he was hosting Akamai. I believe they were doing that for free. And I think they absorbed the attack for 4 days, maybe a week, somewhere in that neighborhood, and then they said, "Hey, man, we've got to boot you out. Sorry." I think the CEO or maybe the CTO or somebody of that effect said from Akamai said something to the effect of, "It's costing us, and you know, or rather, it will be costing us millions of dollars to continue absorbing this. It's just too much traffic." So we actually went offline for a little while, and then in stepped Project Shield from Google, right? Which they're a group that is dedicated to protecting kind of free speech, right? So when you think of DDoS attacks, you don't really think of it as censorship, right? But if somebody's trying to put something out in the public, what better way to shut them up than, you know, if they're doing it on the internet, than to DDoS their site, where if somebody can't get to their material effectively, you've censored them. So Project Shield stepped in and helped and got him back online. And it was the only affordable way because he had researched some other options, and I think it was going to cost him tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars from other services to be able to absorb this. So it's pretty cool project. I for one, I don't know, just the idea of DDoS terrifies me, right? That at any one point in time, somebody could decide I'm a target and then just overwhelm me, but not only affect me, but my livelihood and everybody that I help keep online, you know, it could affect their livelihood. So it's a very personal thing for me, right, as network operators, which everybody listening to this is, well, not everybody, but virtually everybody listening to this is a network operator, right? And the fact that somebody could arbitrarily step in and affect your ability to feed your kids because they want to is fairly upsetting to me. I'm sure Tom has a thing or two to say about security in general, but censorship, right? Because you're such a big advocate of politics and everybody getting their fair share.
Absolutely. Like, what I love about Trump is he actually says what he's thinking, which is unusual. But the fact that he's thinking what he says means he's unfit for office. But no, but forget all that. But like, the idea that I want Trump to be able to express his opinion, as much as I disagree and sometimes hate what he has to say, at least he's saying it, and at least people are listening. And then the counterbalance, you know, I'd like Gary Johnson to have the same platform that Trump has, but or like if Thomas has a great idea, or if Andrew there in Australia has a great idea, I want them to be able to communicate that with us. I think that's what makes humans great, that every big development of humankind has been an advance in the dissemination and the you know, distribution of information. And to whittle that down or curb that in any way, or to give people that power to curb it, it would be so detrimental, I think, to our development as a race, or I mean the human race, the whole lot of us. So yeah, no, it fucks me off, being honest. Like, there was a guy who was running Gmail for years, you know, so it's all the lists, and I'm in it for better or for worse, asking stupid questions about OpenBSD and all this type of stuff. And you can Google it, you know, Google Translate OpenBSD, you'll find all the requests of it. But some guys were unhappy about posting passwords, that the guys posted passwords to some forum. Asked your man to take it down. He says, "Well, no, I'm just an archive of messages that are sent." So he wasn't. So the lads DDoSed him pretty much off the net, and it was offline for a month. And it was actually really frustrating because I was looking for articles that I'd seen there. And of course, if I had a news server, I could have gotten it. But I'm lazy, I leave it to someone else. And basically, these DDoS assholes, which you are, DDoS assholes, if you watch this, stop subscribing to the Brothers Wish. It's an asshole zone. But like, apart from me, I'm the designated one, I'm allowed to be.
That can be the only one. It's Highlander rules, yeah.
No, but like, and they basically DDoS this guy off the internet, and basically, it restricted my ability to get information from other people. And the reason why the guy gmail.org set up his messaging to web archive was to make all this information that was available on web lists and mailing lists and news networks around the world, was to make it accessible to people like you and me. And some dickhead or dickheads decided, no, they're not going to allow them to do that anymore. Luckily, some Japanese guys stepped in and actually helped them out. But it is exactly what you're saying, Greg. Democratization of censorship is kind of a contradiction in terms, almost. It's one way to get me my blood rushing and get me annoyed and get me to use bad language. And it's so easy to perpetrate against people. That's the annoying thing. It's an asymmetric attack. It's kind of like the lowest form of terrorism, as in, you know, the bombing a shopping mall. It's that type of Neanderthal, untargeted bullshit. That's actually not that technically elegant. There's no real...
Yeah, I mean, you're strapping a bomb to your chest and running in a crowd of people to spite one person. And so there's just a lot of collateral damage.
And we all lose in this scenario. So, in fairness, Greg, I think you summed it up in the first 30 seconds really well, and I just added a whole load of hyperbole to it afterwards. But it's good that Project Shield did step in. In fairness to Akamai, I can understand, it is a serious hit. When you're actually taking it from tier ones and they're saying, you know, how much of this? And I think that's where people have to start looking at smart ways of managing denial of service and making that more accessible and stop making it as a pay per view or pay per use. Like, for instance, I could buy transit at sub €1 a meg. But if I want one transit with DDoS protection, it's a lot more expensive. While if they equip me with the ability to signal attacks and actually suppress them myself using my own intelligence on an opt-in model, that's where... So we need to democratize the suppression of denial of service attacks. And that would allow us to do it in a responsible manner, because unfortunately that also leads to censorship. If I can arbitrarily black hole the traffic, it means I can arbitrarily black hole political dissent, for example. So it's that balancing act. But I think there are some technical things that, while we can't solve all problems, we can solve some of them, and those problems that we can solve a little bit, we should solve a little bit and work on the more complex ones afterwards.
Well, something that's interesting to me with this is through a little bit of this research, I was reading and hearing and some speculation and stuff. They're saying a good chunk of DDoS attacks nowadays are in the 60 gigabit per second range. How many ISPs, I'm not talking about level 3, I'm not talking about Cogent, I'm talking about regular ISPs, you know, kind of the tier 2 guys, how many of those do you know that can absorb a 60 gig attack? And to be honest with you, I don't know any. So to me, that means this isn't something you can mitigate yourself. This isn't something you can control anymore, right? You have to use a service of some sort. If you're going to get attacked, that means you no longer have the ability to deal with this yourself. You're going to have to go to somebody else. You're going to have to go to a scrubbing house, or you're going to have to talk to your upstream ISP to absorb it, right? If you do a scrubbing house, that's somebody who will advertise your address space out and then just kind of GRE tunnel it back to you, right? So they can kind of clean it before it gets to you, right? If you're doing it by your ISPs, that means each ISP has to do it. If you're doing it at a scrubbing house, you know, that can go to the scrubbing house first and then come in. So that's a method, but no longer can we absorb these little 1 gig? I mean, still, granted, if you get a 1 gig attack, you can probably absorb it. But the days of those 1 and 2 gigs are starting to kind of fade away, and it's
you're in the U.S. where internet is super cheap.
Well, also, it makes me wonder. You know, so many ISPs, maybe they see this as a pay to play option, right? This is another way to make a little bit of money. So maybe they aren't motivated to be altruistic, like you're saying, Tom. Maybe the money they're making from this DDoS is enough to kind of, you know, let that go and go ahead and just keep accepting money. Because if it's something they're required to do, that means that's infrastructure, a whole lot more infrastructure they're probably going to have to put in to maintain this, and they're going to lose a little bit of money. Are you suggesting maybe they put a little tax on all of our packets to do a little DDoS?
One of the things, I'm a small ISP. We've 1,500 subscribers. We're on INX. We have two peering providers, 10 gig and 1 gig. 1 gig on 10 gig commits. That's kind of the scale we're at. And we were faced with another ISP, which had smaller connectivity in another part of the world. And we're using me, let's say, for consulting services. And they said, look, we're getting hit hard with DDoS. Can you look after us? Can you effectively be the scrubbing house? And so we kind of looked at the situation and literally with the resources we had, we were looking at, well, what can we do, right? And one thing I learned from the bigger ISP players is that if you look at it, that all the trash comes in on your transit links, okay? So transit, in fact, is bad. So when you're thinking of your next upgrade, and this is what I'm saying to all Brothers with subscribers out there, your next upgrade should be a layer 2 circuit to a internet exchange point. And it should be the nearest one past your current one if you have one already, or your nearest one if you're not on one already. And
I would just like to interrupt you, sorry, for a second. This is assuming you are in a country where the nearest IX is not 200 kilometers from you. Because, you know, for us, that's actually the case. We have two IXs in Slovakia. One of them is 200 kilometers. The other is 600 kilometers. So, yeah, sorry. Just saying.
If it is 200 kilometers, London is more than 200 kilometers from Dublin. And we were given reasonable. Okay, it would be double the cost of transit. Now, if you think about it, if you already have transit and you're expanding, double the cost of transit, it's a figure you don't like. No one likes to say double the cost of what I could get if I bought it off Hurricane Electric or Cogent and all that. But what you're actually getting is a different quality. You're actually getting something that you have a huge amount more control over, your inbound traffic. So what I'd be saying is that even if it was 200 kilometers, now I can accept that layer 2 service within Slovakia can be quite expensive, as it is in Ireland. But if you get data center to data center layer 2 services, generally they're quite cost effective compared with, let's say from Thomas Kernak's bedroom to, let's say, the nearest IX. I'd be saying from the nearest data center to Thomas Kernak to the nearest exchange. But that should be reasonably cost-effective, or there should be enough competition there. And certainly that's our experience, let's say, from Ireland to the UK, or Ireland to Amsterdam, and Ireland to Frankfurt. So these are options that we're priced. So for our ISP and our next, our future model is effectively join Lynx, join LoneApp, join AMSIX, join DKIX. And actually take control of a vast majority of the inbound traffic to our network. And that if we get DDoS, if we have to cut our transit loose, that we still have 80 to 90% of our coverage for our clients covered. Because that's the reality. With INX, we cover, which is, the island of Ireland's neutral exchange, that covers around 60 to 70% of our traffic already, 30% from transit. Going to London, I get a few more carriers, and now I get to switch things off as, things heat up. And that's what I'd be saying, is that you get that control. Now, of course, you have to control it. There's no point in having control and then saying, oh, it all just works. But I'm just saying, if you can't afford a scrubbing house, get your hands dirty, dive deep, and try and get internet exchange and take control and actually, it's an old-fashioned way of doing it, but I think it does have significant merits. And compared to scrubbing services, it can be quite cost-effective.
All right, so I've got
data center to data center.
Two thoughts on that. One is, I'm going to register a website in a second called Thomas Kernak's Bedroom. It's going to be something.
I was going to make a joke as well, but
buzzing. And then after that, how is going to internet exchanges helping me mitigate a DDoS attack? I don't understand that.
Okay, here's the thing. Most of the trash, if you're on an exchange, a lot of lads get you to do BCP 38, so a lot of it won't be spoofed. Second thing is you can selectively de-peer from people. So if, let's say, most of your customers' traffic is focused on Western Europe or Northern Europe or whatever, and the US, and you're seeing a lot of traffic come out of Africa or Russia or China, you can de-peer from them. So there, you are no longer reachable from them.
Okay. If you de-peer from them, your IP space is still available via BGP on the internet, so they're still going to reroute and come in your other links, are they not?
True, but what you would do in that case is, okay, so what I'm trying to say is if you black hole the victim IP on your transit peer, right, they're off transit. So what you're trying to do is you want to mitigate the impact of doing that, yeah? So if I withdraw, let's say, andrewcox.com
Thomas from next my server.
Cox's bedroom.
Yeah.
Okay. Also Tess's bedroom. More so Tess's bedroom now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so .com. It's a very long domain name. But if I'm advertising... Okay, so I'm advertising that. It comes under attack. Now, let's say his main target market is Ireland, the UK, and let's say Europe in general, right? If I black hole him on my transit peer, so suddenly North America's offline, Australia is offline, unfortunately. Now, but he's still accessible to all my exchange partners. Now, the exchange partners that mightn't be as clean, I can start dropping them as dropping the advertisement of that /24 into those networks that are actually actively attacking his website. But his website is still available to every exchange that I'm connected with.
So in a nutshell, what you're saying is,
and that's where you get the percentages in terms of your local coverage.
So you're saying that you're going to black hole him on your internet links, but your IX, your stuff that's going to stay local within your region, which is going to be on those internet exchanges, that's still going to be up and available. Is that what you're getting
at? It's still up and available, and it'll be up and available to every peer that's not actively fucking me.
Okay. So I think maybe that works in Ireland, but I don't know that works in the United States. Because, you know, there's, like, I'm thinking of some of our, so I work in a co-location facility, right, a data center, and I'm thinking of our customers and people who access our guys that host private clouds in there are, like, all over the place. None of them are, like, regionally located. And IX in the U.S. kind of sucks. It's not what it is in Europe, right? You can't go in there and catch a lot of regional. And like to Thomas's point, I live in College Station and operate a data center here, and the closest one to me is in Dallas. And I actually head up there so I can hit one, but it's, I don't know, 150 miles or something like that. I mean, it's a 3.5-hour drive for me to get there, so it's a pretty good ways out. So I think maybe in a limited environment that would work, but man, it just doesn't work here in the States, at least for any of the customers that I've work with.
Well, what about the way the European exchanges are opening up in the US? Have you seen a shift towards, let's say, kind of the user ownership model type thing, you know, like, which has worked positively in Europe? I like Thomas, what are the Slovakian IXs like? Are they good or positive?
So I actually just looked, so the closer IX to me, this is the 200 kilometer one, only has 5 peers. That's it. And so that's useless. And one of those is Slovakian Academic Network. The other one is a big regional ISP. And so 5 peers on an IX, you know, not useful at all, basically. And not even Slovak Telecom, which is the local incumbent, or T-com these days, is there, right?
I wish.
And so the other one is, as I said, 600 kilometers. And there's, you know, that's in capital, in Bratislava. So there's pretty much, you know, no... no way for me to utilize any of this. And I also feel this is the case for a lot of the world as well, right? If you think about places like India or Africa or, you know, things like that. And even here in Europe, I mean, we are in Slovakia, we are Central Europe, and still, you know. So I think while you are entirely right, you are entirely right in the concept. It just might not work for, you know, some geographical locations.
Okay, so if you're in Slovakia, what I'd be saying is get a layer 2 pipe to Frankfurt. Okay, sorry. Or, like, but like, in fairness, in Ireland, look, we are lucky, I suppose, that we're an island that bridges Europe to America. So a lot of lads just drop in and say, ah, sure, we'll have a few pints, drop in a big cable to Ireland, and then move on to England or France on our merry way. Thank you guys for doing that, by the way. But, you know, like, because our local exchange has over 100 peers. And then, let's say, Luna Links will be one of the bigger, like, in the world. Like, it would be, like, because you have a lot of African ISPs who get bandwidth out of London, so they peer there. But then, obviously, you've got AMP6 and DKIX. So what the attitude there was more get to a local big enough exchange with a center of gravity that works for you. But at least when you get onto the likes of DKIX or AMP6, you're dealing with a couple of hundred peers. It will shift a significant portion of your traffic onto the exchange, and the traffic inbound to your network will come from the exchange, and you will be able to individually control that on a peer-by-peer basis. So that's the key thing there that's going.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but they are, at the moment, two of the largest exchanges in the world, right?
Yeah.
So I guess
very near both of them.
Yeah, I was going to say. So it works for anyone. It becomes increasingly less effective the further away you get from those, I guess. So it just depends where you are and who you're peering with as to how effective that model is for you.
Yeah,
and in fairness, I think, but you guys can change that. Like Thomas can change it in Slovakia.
Well, there is already an IX, you know, 200 kilometers closer to civilization that only has 5 peers. It doesn't make much sense for me to, you know.
I was going to say, here in the States, it's everything is so spread out. You've been here, Tom. You know what it's like. Everything is so spread out that it's so much cheaper to get DIA than it is to get transport all the way across, right? And so,
don't talk to me about spread out.
Dude, Andrew, everything is right on the coast. So, like, 90% of your country might as well not even exist. It might as well be donut-shaped. There might as well be just a big hole full of water in the middle of it. Nobody hangs out
there. Everyone could be near the coast.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's either lakeside or oceanside. It'd be perfect. All right, guys, so we've ran and rambled, and we ran about an hour and a half. A lot of good material there, which I feel not ashamed for. There was some more stuff on the list we didn't get to, but I love these tangents. I think 90% of anything that we talk about is really in the tangents. So I think we got a lot of good stuff out today. So Andrew has to get out of here, so I got to talk to him first. Andrew Cox, if people are trying to get a hold of you, what's the best way of doing that?
Andrew.cox@brightwifi.com.
Gotcha.
And for anyone that's at Whisperpalooza, come see us at booth 207.
Gotcha. So they're giving away free kangaroos. They're bringing plenty of them with them.
Yeah. See you next week.
See you guys.
Late. And then above us, Tom Smith, where can people get a hold of you?
Tom.smith at wirelessconnect.eu, spelt with a Y, as in Tom.smith, spelt with a Y, wirelessconnect.eu. You can get a hold of me there, or Tom Smith, wirelessconnect.eu, or Tom, wirelessconnect.eu on Skype. That's pretty much it.
There's a lot of trouble. Or you can catch him at Whisper. He's going to be up there with Cox, and I think Mike's going to be there. Probably Justin will be there. Miller's going to be there, I think. So it's going
to
be most
everyone. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to Whisper and just have a chat with a few of the vendors, slag them off about their user interfaces and stuff, and how they can improve quality control.
Gotcha.
Just a little bit.
And you'll get that out between
some more
beers.
Vendor management, right?
Yeah, there you go.
Some vendor management, that's what... They'll need crowd management with me, you know. Angry crowd management.
Good.
No,
Lord.
But I'm looking forward to just banging a few heads together.
Excellent.
Banging tables and stuff.
Sounds tremendous, man. Sounds great. All right, Thomas Kurnick, how can people get a hold of you?
Facebook, LinkedIn, email, whatever, really. Just Google me. I'm not that hard to find.
He's got this Unimus thing. You might check it out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. Check out Unimus if you feel like it.
There you go. You got to promote that brand, brother. You always got to be pimping it. You get it out there.
No, it is. It's, I have to say, and I was skeptical, but the user interface is awesome. The database encryption is awesome. So yeah. I have to... Yeah, absolutely. It's way better than Rancid. It's way easier to use, way quicker to deploy. In fairness, it has a good user experience. So well done, Thomas.
Absolutely. All right. You guys can find me at on the email, greg@gregsoul.com. Speaking of always pushing that brand, I just use my name because I'm uninventive and non-creative. Let's see. You can also find me at strayanet.com, trying to do the MDU ISP thing. If you guys have an MDU, you want to throw an internet, I'd be happy to get in there and pay the MDU owner a whole bunch and then just take my little bit for me and definitely make it worth your while. Let's see what else. You can also contact us as a whole either on Facebook. That's Mike's baby, so all those posts you see in up there, and occasionally I'll put one up every like month, but not much. That's all Mike taking care of that, so you can get us on there. You can also reach us via email at contact@thebrotherswisp.com. Again, that's contact or contact us. I thought it was cute to kind of add the us, you know, representative of the whole. We've gotten a total of 2 emails. I'm pretty proud of that. So keep that going, guys, for sure. Also, one last note from me. Nanog 68 is coming up in Dallas, and this is going to be my first Nanog. I figured I'd give it a try. I don't know. I don't know anybody that's going to be there, so hopefully somebody will reach out to me and save me from my loneliness. Otherwise, I'll just be cramped up in my room by myself because I'm extremely antisocial. I am, too. You just got to get past the thick candy shell. Let's see. So reach out to us, Facebook, email, questions, comments, keep them coming. We really like, or I don't know about we, I would really like to do a Q&A sort of thing. I kind of like that. I think the idea that you guys obviously have questions, and sometimes we just ramble on about random things. We don't necessarily know what you're thinking about or what you're interested in. So if you don't give us any guidance, you're going to hear the same crap over and over. So please help us mix it up. So again, from all of us, thanks, and we'll see you next time.
Actually, just before you do, a friend of mine passed away, and she was responsible for teaching me to speak properly and express myself publicly.
All these obscenities, that's her problem. That's her fault.
The obscenities, in fairness, she would have dialed me back well on, in fairness. She was pretty awesome, and she was pretty good, almost like closest thing to her. A real life fairy godmother, but she passed away. She's well over 90. Her age, like, it was one of those secrets that Edward Snowden couldn't actually leak out, like, he couldn't get. But as long as I knew, like, remember her, she always had gray hair. And she really, honestly, there's times when I'd be, you know, going on stage and I'd be frightened out of my wits. And she said, just practice, practice, practice. Grand, and now it's the reason why I have no shame and I can do what I do. So thank you, Frankie Bergen. You are awesome, and rest in peace and love you.
All right, thoughts and prayers for Frankie Bergen, and thank all of you guys. Bye.